You're listening to the Legion of Reason.
Welcome to the Legion of Reason diversion once again. This is episode 208 for July 9th, 2017, and we have a special guest with us today, Dr. Gleb Sapirsky, who is a rational thinker and believes in a rationally thinking-oriented way of life. He is a professor at Ohio State University and serves as the president of Intentional Insights, a nonprofit organization devoted to popularizing such topics. So welcome, Gleb, to our little humble periodical.
Thanks so much, Randy. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Would you like to add something to that? I mean, tell us a little bit about obviously the pro-truth pledge we're going to be talking about.
Sure. Happy to do that. So my background is in the history of behavioral sciences. So how do people make decisions? Why they make those decisions? How their decision go wrong. So in politics, business, and other life areas, Intentional Insights popularizes the research on decision-making and rational thinking. Rational thinking is necessary to make wise decisions. So we at Intentional Insights, I'm a professor. I co-founded it with my wife about 3 years ago. She has an MBA in nonprofit management, so she knows how to run the operations. I'm more of a public face, a front face person who knows the content. And we've been doing a whole bunch of things. I met Kristi Inchelska actually through our previous work on meaning and purpose. And with her, we collaborated with Atheist Alliance International on a project in that area. But with the unfortunate situation in the US and UK political systems in the 2014, 2015, and 2016, we decided at Intentional Insights to really focus our energy on politics much more. We decided that this is a much more tragic and necessary area where people were making horrible decisions and were exhibiting extreme irrationality. And so we decided to do something about it. So we've been focusing on this area. And this is how we came up with the Pro-Truth Pledge project, which is designed to roll back the tide of lies in politics and promote truth and rational thinking. So that is a little bit of a background on me and what we're trying to do.
Well, one of the things that in politics we're trying to apply critical thinking skills to that, one of the things is competing goals. I mean, for instance, do you know Michael Shermer when he came out claiming that the only rational point of view from a skeptic's perspective would be libertarianism? I don't agree. And I see it as being at cross purposes with varying outlooks on what our end goal should be. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I totally hear you, Randy. Yes, I think that Michael made the typical mistake that religious people make when they think that God is like them. There's a lot of research showing that religious people think that God shares whatever values they share. So if a religious person is libertarian, she will think that God is libertarian. If a religious person is extreme liberal, that's what the religious person will think God is. And extreme conservative, that's the religious person will think God is. So Michael Shermer made the same classical mistake in regard to a rational person. He thought to himself, well, I'm a rational person, therefore other rational people should be like me, and I'm libertarian, and therefore that's the right thing to do.
And that's
a classical mistake. It's a classical mistake. It's very easy to make and very tempting. And so that's in the behavioral science literature, that's called failing at other minds. It's basically a projection. So people project their beliefs onto others, and they think that their beliefs are the only right ones. And what he's making the basic mistake on is differentiating between values and methods. All rational people should use the same methods. They don't necessarily start from the same values, and therefore they're not going to come to the same conclusions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, that's why there are competing political ideologies. People have very different views on how a nation or even a local government should be run. Yes. And so how do we come to some kind of I don't want to say consensus, but an agreement, a social contract in that kind of, when we have very, widely disparate political theories?
The fundamental thing that we've been looking at and seeing, what is the problem in our society? Why is there so much polarization? Why is there so much breakdown? We've been seeing that with Brexit in the UK, lies and deceptions and so on. We've been seeing that with the election of Trump in the US, lies and deceptions and so on. Turkey is undergoing an authoritarian transition right now.
Oh, yeah.
Russia underwent that authoritarian transition about a decade ago. And this is happening in a number of other countries as well. Fortunately, Canada is better off than many other states in this regard, and I'm really glad to see that. But there are certainly post-truth approaches, some post-truth politicians in Canada as well, unfortunately, who try to lie and deceive and get their way, get their goals achieved that way. So the fundamental problem is lack of agreement on methods. We can have different values, but if we share an agreement on methods and what are the appropriate methods to approach our political system, then that is the key. That is the fundamental thing that will allow us to have a healthy and collaborative process for achieving our mutual goals. People tend to forget that what unites us is far more than what divides us. So when I personally am a liberal, but when I talk to conservatives, I am aware that the conservative cares about her family and wants to have a nice and peaceful life and so on. The things that actually divide us are about 3% of the reality that unites us. You know, maybe with a liberal, I'll share 99%, and with a conservative, I'll share 97%, and with a really extreme conservative, maybe I'll share something like 90%. But still, we share much more than what divides us. And the fundamental thing that we have to think about is, what are the methods that are going to result in a healthy collaborative path forward? So that's what the pro-truth pledge is about: how to establish those shared methods of rational collaborative discourse.
Yeah, it's amazing that such a small difference of opinion has resulted in such sharp, the very sharp lines of demarcation between right, left, and center, and to the point of, well, it has been to the point of violence. I mean, we've seen the left becoming very violent with Antifa in the U.S. and not so much up here, even though they exist, but we're a little more polite about it. You know how Canadians are.
Not in hockey, but yes.
Well, not in hockey. No. That's I think it's kind of like the pressure release valve. We get this pent up frustration, and I think hockey is the big one for us. But
Uncle Justin Trudeau kind of takes it on the.
Well, he's unboxing. Yeah, he's the boxer. It's how do you point this out to people? Because it's very difficult to talk. But as a centrist, it's difficult to talk to the left or the right because they are very set. It's very concrete. Whereas a centrist, we kind of try to look at both. Some people have this wrong idea of centrism, that we split the difference. That's not true.
No.
What I do is I take what works from if it happens to be part of the left's agenda or the right's agenda, so be it. I'm a pragmatist. So to me, what can be shown to work, what can be shown to produce the desired goals, whatever those may be, that's to me what defines a centrist. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but that to me, as a centrist, that's the way I work. So
I'm not going to disagree. That's what you define as a centrist. Different people will, define centrist as different, and I'm very comfortable saying that that's what you believe. So,
yes, exactly. it's very much a it's not noncommittal, because we do, as a centrist, I do strongly adhere to certain goals and certain ways of getting there. But talking to the right or the left has become increasingly difficult because of this polarization. What was the start of this polarization in politics, especially in the U.S.?
It's hard to describe what the start was. I would say I've been doing some research about this for my new book, which is called The Alternative to Alternative Facts, Fighting Post-Truth Politics with Behavioral Science. It'll be coming out in 2018. So what I've been able to determine is that the destruction of the traditional mainstream media consensus and the respect for traditional mainstream media that started in about the early part of this millennium, so kind of around 2003, 2004 is when you see the decreasing trust in mainstream media and in association with the rise of online media, and especially in the recent year has been seen Trump. I mean, that has been a huge, huge blow to mainstream media. If you look at trust in mainstream media among Republicans in 2015 and compare that to 2016, you see that the trust in mainstream media has fallen by more than half, from 2015 to 2016. So where they're relying much more on Trump and kind of conservative media as the source of their information as opposed to traditional mainstream media. So that's a big problem. But it started, you see this drop off starting around 2003, 2004, really intensifying with the growth of social media.
Yeah, growth of social media and then the growth of the Breitbarts and stuff telling them all not to believe in mainstream media.
Yep. Yes. So Breitbart has really accomplished what it did through social media. So how Breitbart became the biggest news site in the United States. It's the biggest. It's bigger than Huffington Post, bigger than anything. It did so through very effective use of social media. So when it posts an article on Facebook, it boosts it to certain targeted demographics, and that's how it was able to gather its audience.
Interesting. By the way, that was Twyla.
That Bannon.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to introduce you, Twyla, because I don't think Gleb has met you. Her Indian name, if she had one, would be Dodging Tornadoes.
Yeah, that's what we're doing tonight. But they're a little bit south. Innisfail's only about half an hour away, but that seems to be where they are tonight.
Yeah, we're having some serious weather coming our way. At least our summer is not being stolen from us again.
It's hot.
It's nice and hot. It's nice and hot. Anyway, go ahead.
Nice and hot. Oh.
It sounds to me that
America has rewarded Breitbart, which I'm talking about Bannon here, with the White House.
Sure. Yes. This is because it works. This sort of appeal works. I mean, why would it blow your mind? You and I, the listeners of this show are different than the mainstream audience. This is one of the things, the classic mistake that Michael Shermer made when he said that, I am like the rest, I am like all rational thinkers, and if you're not libertarian, you're irrational. That's a classic mistake.
But if you look at Bannon, the guy is a criminal. He's an abuser. He's not exactly what I would think the right-wingers would flock to, but they have.
You're kidding, right? Look who they elected.
Be careful to not make the same mistake that Michael Shermer made. You're looking at these people and you're outraged. You're like, how can they make that decision?
Look at Bannon?
You're projecting a little bit on your perspective on them. They have different values.
Look at Bannon.
Again, I hear you. But they have different values. They don't really care about Bannon being the kind of things I care about, the kind of things you care about.
They care about Christian values. And what about Bannon is a Christian value?
No. They don't care about that. That's just for that. That just plays in the sticks.
They don't show by their actions that they care. So there's a concept called revealed motivations, where you don't look at what people say, but you look at what people do. And that shows you where their real values are.
Exactly.
They may pay lip service to Christian values, but you can see by their actions what they actually care about. And
he's a racist and hated Obama, and I guess they like lies.
I don't know that he's a racist at all.
Bannon is a huge racist.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, Bannon's a bit of a white supremacist, but maybe not a white supremacist, but a what's the term I'm looking for? He's not a bigot. And conservative people do have a
thinks he's
there's a lot of this identity
else?
Politics that goes around, Actually, that's not something I really would like to ask, is how much of a factor was identity politics in the rise of Donald Trump?
It was a very powerful factor. So when you look at the research on what Donald Trump appealed to and who Donald Trump appealed to, he appealed to certain demographics, certain groups. And he target, and again, these are people who are not like you and I. These are not people like the listeners of this show. The people who are listening to this show tend to be rational, reason-oriented people.
What I hope so.
We need to remember, right? What we need to remember is that we're not like a large majority of other people around us. Mm-hmm. Other people tend to be much less rational. They tend to be much more emotional. And what they do is they don't go with their heads. They tend to go with their guts. And when you appeal to their guts, they go like, yes, that's a person who speaks to my gut. That's a person who's authentic. So these are the kinds of people who Trump and Bannon and Breitbart very successfully appealed to. They were very successful at targeting this demographic, and they used new social media tools that allowed them to specifically reach these people. So you had a lot of people voting in the 2016 election in the United States who didn't vote previously. You had a whole bunch of people doing the same thing in Brexit. And you know what? In Brexit and in the US, you had similar companies, not similar, the same companies. Companies like Cambridge Analytica and Aggregate IQ, they worked both for Donald Trump and for the Brexit Leave campaign. Mm-hmm. And they were both funded by people like Robert Mercer, he is the main money behind Donald Trump, and he's the main money behind Cambridge Analytica. People who are listening to the podcast right now can go to the Cambridge Analytica website and they can look at the website, and it uses the case of Donald Trump as saying, hey, look at all these very effective advertisements we ran that reached these people and convinced them through their emotions to vote for Donald Trump, and by using data aggregation. They're very open about this. They're not hiding what they're doing. They just know that the actual voter demographic who votes for Donald Trump won't go to Cambridge Analytica, and they won't try to figure this stuff out because they don't care. They don't go with their heads, they go with their guts. So if you're going with your gut, you're not like the people who are listening to this show. You're a different sort of beast. You have different sort of thinking patterns and feeling patterns. And that's what we need to understand. We need to understand what we're dealing with. And we need to understand how to reach these people.
I think that's why the when they go low, we go high did not work at all.
Mm. Well, the moment that we vilify these people, the moment we sort of surrender trying to understand them. So
saying someone's so. Going low, so we're going to go high is not going to, put them in your camp either.
No.
Yeah. But I don't think we should vilify them. We should understand them.
Yes.
So fundamentally, something that we truly are better at than people like that who go with their gut is understanding. Now, Michael Shermer showed an example of where he did not really understand.
Well, to be fair, he backtracked. He actually,
It's good that he backtracked, yes. But in the first place, to make that sort of statement shows a lack of understanding how people work and how people think. So when you try to understand people who go with your gut, you can intellectualize yourself into their shoes. You can overcome the intuitive desire to project yourself and say, how can these people make these outrageous decisions and, go with Bannon and, they must be crazy and so on. Well, you have to look at their shoes. They are heroes in their own story. So looking at the behavioral science research, everyone is a hero in their own story. They have motivations that they believe are positive in doing what they're doing. They think they're doing the right thing. They don't think of themselves as bad, racist people. That's not how they think of themselves. They think of themselves as protecting their country, as defending their tribe against foreign invasions and whatever other tales, myths has been spun out by Breitbart and so on.
And so how do you even counteract those myths? How do you tell them, well, the thing to fear is the robots, not the who's actually taking your jobs? How do you even appeal to that?
So that's what I was mentioning with the pro-truth pledge. We have examined a lot of what is wrong with our country. And one of the fundamental things that's going on is that people don't value truth. They don't care about what is actually true. And they might pay lip service to it, like they pay lip service to Christian values, but they don't actually show in their actions they care about. For example, they don't fact check before they share articles. If you look at the article sharing on fake news in the 3 months before the 2016 election, you'll see that the top 20 fake news stories on Facebook outcompeted the top 20 real news stories.
Yeah.
There were 8 million engagements, 8 million plus engagements by the top 20 fake news stories, and only 7 million plus engagements by top 20 real news stories.
Well, let me guess, one of those was Pizzagate, right?
I'm sure it was. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but yes. So,
how can anybody believe ridiculous? I mean, there's fake news, and then there's like way out there, you've got to be kidding me, fake news. And that one was the latter. But people bought it.
Alex Jones the other day, he had some guest on that said that there's a pedophilia ring
on Mars.
NASA was sending, kids to Mars.
Exactly.
What's going on?
So it gets
a pedophilia ring on Mars.
Colony.
They must have come from the pizza parlor.
Pizza, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Now it's
and pizza parlors.
They got better technology in pizza parlors than we do in NASA.
Some guy believed it so much he went to the pizza parlor with a gun.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
It's easy to laugh at this, and I can understand that, and I laugh at it myself in a way. But then you also have to look at polls. You know, when Donald Trump claimed that he won the popular election, whereas Hillary Clinton won it by nearly 3 million votes. You know, you and I can laugh, and your listeners can laugh.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to look too hard about that one.
But that seems like, to me, that seems pretty much as out there as the Pizzagate in a similar way. But over half of Republicans believe that Donald Trump won the popular vote. Over half of them believe that. I mean, the large majority of them believe that Obama ordered Trump Tower wiretapped in the 20...
Just because they said so.
Just because he said so, yes, exactly. And
so what are you going to do with a bunch of biased people that'll swallow any crap that Trump dips on them?
So there's some really interesting research on climate science
and other science
communication. How do you actually convince people on climate science?
Oh, okay.
If you give them information that, you know, to climate science deniers that their beliefs are wrong, they will not listen.
Of course
not. You know, it's counterintuitive.
They're not wrong.
They don't want to feel wrong. Now, you and I, if we're given information that we're wrong in something, we're like, oh, this is really interesting. I want to have the best beliefs. Let me update toward these more correct beliefs because I want to have the most accurate perspective on reality, right? Like, that's the best thing to do for us. But that's not how they think. So it doesn't work for them to be given accurate information. What does work much more effectively is to start at the baseline. Tell them how science functions. Say, hey, here's the thing. You have an idea about something. And then you conduct an experiment and you see if it works out. You know, for example, you have an idea that if you hammer these two sticks together, these two planks together, they will hold each other together. And you hammer them together and you see that it works. So you have proved your hypothesis and so on. And, you know, and then you go further and you talk with them about, well, how would you test whether global warming is happening caused by humans? What kind of experiments would you run to test these sorts of things? And going further, you can show them that here are the kind of tests that have been run that cause scientists to believe in these things. They're much more likely to follow along with you. So
you're not attacking them, but you're showing them how this happened.
Right, exactly. So the Pro-Truth Pledge at protruthpledge.org does the same thing. So for...
How do you do with Pizzagate?
You don't start with Pizzagate. You start with the underlying principles. Just like you start with the underlying science, the scientific method.
But if the underlying principle is racism, how do you deal with that?
So again, you start... The underlying, what we're talking right now, with Pizzagate, we're talking about lies and deceptions, people believing that, swallowing that whole. So to address people swallowing lies, we need to get people to agree on what are the principles of truth. What are, in the same way that you get them to agree and accept the scientific method, you get them to accept what are truth-oriented behaviors. Because, you know, most people don't know what it means to orient toward the truth. Most people don't have education in critical thinking, unlike you know, unlike us who are talking about this stuff, and the listeners, the vast majority of the listeners to this show, had exposure and education and critical thinking, I mean, through this show and other venues. But most people don't. They don't have exposure to critical thinking. So you got to start them at the base level. You got to get them to commit to truth-oriented behaviors. You say, hey, you want to be a truth-oriented person. You tell the truth, right? Most people would say yes, they do. And then you go to protruthpledge.org, and I invite those who are following along to go to the website at protruthpledge.org and check it out. And that lists clear truth-oriented behaviors that anyone looking at this, you know, let's say the vast majority of people who are looking at it can agree that these are truth-oriented behaviors. And there are 12 behaviors. I'll just read a couple of them. I'll read a few. Fact-check information to confirm it is true before accepting and sharing it. Distinguish between my opinions and the facts. Align my opinions and my actions with accurate information. Ask people to retract information that reliable sources have disproved, even if those people are my allies. And celebrate those who retract incorrect statements and update their beliefs toward the truth. And 7 more behaviors. So these are things, just like the scientific method, people can agree on the principle that these are the right behaviors to follow if you want to be oriented toward the truth. So once you get people on this agreement, this basic fundamental agreement, these principles, this is what it means to orient toward the truth. And then you can talk to them about seeing whether other people who they can observe around them are following these principles or not. Now, this gets quite, we can talk about it in depth about the pro-truth pledge, but I wanted to respond to your question very clearly. How do you get people who believe in crazy things to dial down the craziness?
the most recent one, well, you know, how Ivanka was at G20, took her father's place. Someone said that Obama's daughter did the same thing. That's not true.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, no, that definitely didn't happen. Photoshop.
It's like they invent things to go along that to make it seem okay.
That's right. That's exactly what they do. So, but the reason they do it is because it feels good to them. Whereas
it hurts my head.
I understand. I understand. It's really hard. It's hard to accept that there are people like that in the world. So what we need to do, I mean, let's be clear. We're not going to reach all of them, but Trump was elected by 60,000 votes in some key swing states. You know, Brexit took place, but I don't remember. A few hundred thousand votes, I think, was the determinant of Brexit, something like that. So you don't need to reach all of them. You know, there are so many people who are reachable, who are not going to go and shoot up Pizzagate, but who are going to be like, you know, pizza parlor, but who will be like, oh, this is an article that speaks to my values. I'm going to reshare it. Even if they might be a little bit skeptical internally, that's true. Then, you know, people don't share articles necessarily because they believe them. Research on lying. So I've done quite a bit of reading on the research on lying and writing this new book. And if anyone wants to a really good book on the research on lying, I'd recommend Dan Ariely's The Truth About Dishonesty. Mm-hmm. So Why We Lie. So it's a really good book. And one of the things he shows is that people are strongly incentivized to lie if they think it will benefit their tribal group, if they think it will benefit people who are like them, who they feel affiliated with. So imagine if you see an article coming across your newsfeed, and it's an article that speaks to your values, to your in-group, and you think that you will be an online activist by sharing this article. Even if you're a little bit skeptical the article is true, if you're not already a truth-oriented person, if being truthful is not an important part of your identity, you'll be like, I'll share it and I'll be an online activist and maybe it's not a true thing, but whatever.
So it's a lot of confirmation bias is what you're saying.
Yeah.
That people engage
more,
in.
Yeah, it's more complex than confirmation bias. Confirmation bias refers to people seeking out and interpreting information in ways that aligns with their beliefs.
So this is a more subtle version. Yeah. Sorry. Did you get that? I was just saying this is a more subtle version of that, where people are spreading stories which, you know, that align
sounds
with their own beliefs.
Yeah.
And in an attempt to Is it to convert, or is it just to uphold the current, you know, like, you know, keep these people in the fold? I think we just lost them. Did we lose somebody?
He's back.
Oh, he's back. Okay. Sorry there. Gleb, are you there?
There was a drop, though.
Oh.
Nope, it's dropped now. Well, I find a lot of people share that stuff and trying to convince me that it's actual evidence.
I've been caught a couple of times on satire sites thinking that, you know, what I was sharing was real. It's been, you know, quite a while since that happened, but there was one about Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that she'd said some crazy thing, and it just seems so plausible.
Yeah.
Because you that's know, like the that kind of stuff line. She says.
Yeah. And that, like, that gray line between satire and,
hello?
You know.
Yeah, we're over here. Sorry, God.
Okay, good. Okay, yes. So there was a cut off for some reason.
Yeah, we
anyway, the last thing we talked about was the confirmation bias. And it's a little bit more complex than the confirmation bias. Here we're talking about something called in-group bias, where people are favorably disposed to things that favor their group, their tribe. And here this is about a tribal perspective. So people perceive things that are favorable to their tribe, and they are more willing to deceive if it supports their tribe.
Yeah, so there's that lying for Jesus thing.
Not sure what you're talking about there, but...
I'm not sure if I can think of an example, but they'll lie about something and say it's a miracle, even though it wasn't, and they know it wasn't.
Okay, so that's what you mean by lie for Jesus. Yes, I got you. Yes, similar concept, yes. So people who are willing to lie for their in-group, for their tribe, for their values. So that's one way that's one thing that causes people to be more likely to lie. Another thing that causes people to be more likely to lie is if they don't think they will be caught out by lying, and if they won't be punished for it. That's another thing that will make people more likely to lie.
I think with Trump, he thinks he can get away with any outrageous lie.
Mm-hmm. And
no one will call him out on it.
It's pretty clear that he can. I mean, I think he's not wrong. So he is being called out, but he's quite effectively...
Not by his people, though, not by his tribe.
Exactly. So he is being very effectively demonizing those who call him out. So he doesn't care about being called out, I think would be more accurate. So he's not being punished for lying. So one of the aspects of the pro-truth pledge is... asking people to retract information that reliable sources have disproved, even if those people are my allies. And compassionately informing those around me to stop using unreliable sources, even if these sources support my opinion, whether it's Breitbart News on the right or Occupy Democrats on the left, those are unreliable sources.
Or so, David Wolf.
Yes.
Alex or AJ Jones. Plus.
Whatever... Whatever, you know, bias source you can think of, unreliable sources, not using them. And what is really important, we find, is for getting enough people in each person's social circle, each person's tribe, who will have taken the pro-truth pledge. The pro-truth pledge is for anyone to take. So if people take the pro-truth pledge, one of the things they commit to is asking people in their social circle to retract information that reliable sources have disproved, even if they're my allies. And so once we have enough people in the social circles of these more conservative-oriented people or more liberal-oriented people who share Occupy Democrats pieces, if they're being called out, they are now being punished by people in their social circle, by people who they care about for sharing misinformation. So that's one thing that we want to change through the pro-truth pledge. Another big thing that we want to change is the phenomenon of people being called flip-floppers if they change their minds. That's a very pejorative term.
I was going to bring that up because I think we need to stop, especially when it comes to politicians, when they change their minds, that we should not vilify them. I have called out people for this before because changing one's mind is a sign of strength, or it can be a sign of strength, not of weakness.
Yeah, it's a virtue. It's a virtue to be able to change one's mind.
And I just can't stand it when people, you know, this politician, like Obama, changed his mind on same-sex marriage. And I'm like, he flip-flopped. Well, no, he just flipped, first of all. Okay. If they flip-flop in, we might have a case. But okay, he just flipped. And that's fine. He'd flip, you know, it depends on why. I mean, he told us why. But you know, if it's for good sound reasons, somebody's mind has changed, congratulations. We got to stop vilifying people who have had their minds changed.
Absolutely. And this is one of the early aspects of the pledge, the last behavior, celebrating those who retract incorrect statements and update their beliefs toward the truth. So instead of condemning flip-floppers, you celebrate people who update their beliefs. For example, there was a congressional candidate in Idaho, well, he's a congressional candidate, Michael Smith, who took the pro-truth pledge. And one of the things we do as part of the pro-truth pledge is evaluate public figures like himself who take the pro-truth pledge. Anyone who is a public figure, whether it's a congressional candidate, whether it's a podcast show host, whether it's a blogger who has an impact on the public sphere. So we evaluate those people. And so he posted a post on his Facebook wall of a tweet made by Donald Trump, you know, saying that, oh, minority children are too disruptive to be in the classroom. Yeah. You know, kind of ridiculous statement. And then that was shared by a bunch of people. But then it wasn't on Donald Trump's feed. So kind of talked to him about it. And he, you know, he acknowledged that, well, you know, either Donald Trump deleted the tweet or it was Photoshopped to look like it was Donald Trump feed, which some people have done. And so he edited the statement that he made on Facebook saying, you know, due to a pro-truth pledge I have taken, I can no longer say that this post is necessarily accurate. So that's exactly the kind of behavior we want from politicians who take the pro-truth pledge. We want them to retract statements that are not sure about anymore and update their beliefs.
Sharing the fake news.
Exactly. And so we celebrate the people who do that. We celebrate their updating. You don't say, you know, you did a bad job by sharing this false thing. It's like, great job. Thank you for retracting it and making a public statement of your retraction. That's exactly what we want to see. I'd love to see politicians do this all around the country and other public figures do this.
That and the way you ended it on a positive note, I shared some old news and someone told me to cut it out and quit being so stupid. I said, why don't you help me out, post the update and don't deride me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, he couldn't do that. So I had to block him because it was just being rude.
Yep. Yeah. So this is why this is one of the things that we call celebrate updating. So it's a very positive thing. It's not a gotcha game. When people sign up for the pledge, and we want as many people as possible to sign up the pledge, we want, you know, all the people who are listening to this podcast to go to protruthpledge.org and sign up. One of the things they can do is they can be volunteers for the pledge and get other signatures, lobby public figures to take the pledge, and especially monitor politicians and other public figures who take the pledge. So kind of, you know, once we get enough of them who have taken it. And we have a bunch already who took it. Something like over 90 public figures who took it, various caliber, ranging from people like, you know, in the high profile, people like Peter Singer and people, a lot of secular leaders like Dan Barker, August Brandsman, and so on. We have a whole bunch of politicians who took it, but we also have clergy people who took it. We have an Episcopal bishop who took it. So a whole bunch of people from various walks of life, public figures who took it. And of course, ordinary citizens. So we need as many ordinary people to take it, because one of the things they do is evaluate public figures like Michael Smith and others to make sure they stick to the pledge. So have that verification and the process of accountability.
So where can people find this pledge?
At protruthpledge.org. So the website is protruthpledge.org. So that's the mechanism that I and a bunch of other behavioral scientists and concerned citizens have come up with to try to change our society to orient toward truth instead of lies. So shifting the dynamic, shifting the public discourse, and verifying people who took the pro-truth pledge. So, you know, if you're a public figure and you take the pro-truth pledge, you know that you're being monitored. So you know that you're being watched to make sure that you stick to the pro-truth pledge. And if you do something like Michael Smith did, somebody will, you know, go behind the scenes, privately ask you to retract a statement, and we'll do a whole bunch of things privately to try to get the person to retract the statement. We've never yet had a case where the person didn't, but we have a mechanism for if the person refuses to retract the statement and it's a clear piece of misinformation, then at that stage we'd go to the media. So you know, it would be, let's say, the media in Michael Smith's congressional district. We'd go to them and tell them that, hey, Michael Smith took the pro-truth pledge, then he shared this piece of misinformation. We tried a bunch of times to get him to retract it. He wouldn't. So now we're judging that he intended to lie. He didn't just make a mistake. Any of us can make a mistake. I can make a mistake. You can make a mistake. It's mm-hmm. fine. He intended to lie. He deliberately tried to deceive. And he's in contempt of the pro-truth pledge. That's one. Second is that we will send an action alert to all the people in Michael Smith's congressional district who signed the pro-truth pledge for them to tweet him, email him, message him, call him, meet with him, protest his office, and so on. Basically raise a big stink about him being in contempt of the pro-truth pledge. So it's kind of a pretty big public penalty, a reputational penalty. If you intend to lie, you're better off not taking the pro-truth pledge at all. So this is kind of a way of differentiating people who are truth-oriented or who are at least willing to abide by these behaviors for the sake of having that verified mechanism, external mechanism, saying, yes, you have not made any false statements and not retracted them after making those false statements. So you have that kind of public seal of approval, like the Business Bureau, and versus people who don't have that. So that is an important difference for people who are looking outside and seeing that label. Okay, he's someone who took the pro-truth pledge. He has the pro-truth pledge badge on his website. You know, that's cool. I can trust that person is much more likely to be honest than Joe Schmo who didn't.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, this also kind of has to have a shift in public perception of, in terms of politicians that lie. Because, I mean, look at Donald Trump. I mean, he has made up facts all along, and yet it hasn't harmed him. He's still the lowest what's that? Yeah, he's got his presidency is at the lowest approval rating of, well, pretty much any president. So it doesn't seem to hurt him, though. It doesn't change his behavior.
It doesn't change his behavior, I agree. However, it's partially the case that the people who currently support him, they don't know really what it means to be truth-oriented. Some of them think they are being truth-oriented. Some of them think that they are doing the right thing. I'll give you an example. So we went, there's an organization called Rotary Club. Rotary clubs are service clubs. They are at the start of a Rotary Club. You do the Pledge of Allegiance and a Christian prayer. So it's kind of a conservative Christian-leaning organization. And there are Rotary clubs all across the United States and all across Canada and UK, you know, everywhere. So this is a conservative Christian leaning organization, and they are made up of business professionals, community leaders of various sorts, where politicians get a lot of their support from these people.
Yeah.
So we have a volunteer who is a small business leader, and she took the pro-truth pledge, and the Rotary clubs have speakers most weeks, so probably like twice a month or something like that, depending on the Rotary club. So they have a need for speakers. She went to the Rotary club. She talked to them about the pro-truth pledge, and 25% of the people there took the pro-truth pledge. So 25% of the membership. That's a pretty high rate of return. Now, if those people then see a politician who, you know, let's say a conservative Christian politician, who chooses not to take the pro-truth pledge, and they have themselves taken the pro-truth pledge, that will make a difference. That drives a wedge between those people. Or the conservative Christian politician can choose to take the pro-truth pledge, but then he or she needs to stick by it. Otherwise, they'll get in trouble, and a pretty serious public penalty. So there are plenty of people within the Donald Trump demographic who voted for him who are definitely reachable and who think that they do care about the truth, but it's hard for them to know what the truth is. And because of their tribal perspective, they often choose to go with things that are deceitful as opposed to orient toward truthful things.
So it's kind of a way of verification or validation and verification.
Or at least trying to make people a little more accountable.
Yep. That's how it functions. And it's also quite beneficial for politicians if one person in a race takes the pro-truth pledge and another one does, then the person who took the pro-truth pledge can attack the person who didn't take the pro-truth pledge. You know, hey, what are you lying about? What do you have to hide? So it's a quite useful tool for politicians to take. Now, so they can choose to take it, but then they have to stick by it.
Yeah.
So it has its, you know, I've had public figures tell me that, like, well, you know, you don't have enough momentum yet for me to take the pro-truth pledge. It would cost more than it's worth it for me to take the pro-truth pledge. Come back to me when you have more signups.
So sign up, people. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. Well, it would, because a lot of the times politicians will half-truth things. They'll stress the positive of something and push the negative under the table. Now, this is included within this pledge?
Yeah, one of the aspects is the second behavior. Share the whole truth, even if some aspects do not support my opinion.
That's a tough thing for a politician to do, yeah. I got it.
I agree.
In skeptic circles, we hold each other to that already, so we're kind of used to it. But I've noticed it gets tenuous. And the reason why this is so awesome is if someone has taken it and is not used to it and has to actually look at it. I have a hard time approaching people when they share some of that stuff. And now there's a tool to say, well, okay, have you done this? And would you look at it without attacking me?
Yeah, one of the things that people have found quite useful is using this pro-truth pledge as a filter for who they choose to have conversations with. You know, I hear from so many people that they're so frustrated with conversations they have with friends and family and online and so on. And that's really tough for them to have these conversations with people who shift the goalposts and argue in a rational way. Now they start to say, hey, this is a tough conversation to have. We clearly have different opinions. How about you take the pro-truth pledge and commit to sticking to it, and then I'll be willing to have the conversation with you. Otherwise, it's not worth my time.
That's
yeah.
Cool.
Interesting. So what else? What do we got here? Chris, had a question you wanted to bring up.
Yeah, well, when you fell offline for a minute there, I was talking about a couple of times when I reposted satire that seemed so realistic. Like there was one about Michelle Bachmann, and it sounded just exactly like the kind of behavior she'd do. So, you know, of course, I corrected myself. But, you know, how do you tell? Like that satire is a fine line, hey?
Yeah, I mean, if it's we ask people to do things like clarifying, so the clarify behavior. Distinguish mm-hmm. between my opinion and the facts would address this. So when you post satire, you want to clearly indicate that it's satire.
So yeah, lesson learned.
In a clear way so that you don't think that it's satire. I mean, there are a bunch of people who post an article, and when it's obviously a fake article, and then people come back to them and say, hey, why did you share this article? It's fake news. And they're like, well, I shared it because I wanted to share an obviously stupid thing, and I thought that everybody would get it because I'm sharing it because it's stupid. I'm
like, at least say that to you, yeah. People you share stuff without comment, and I know the person wouldn't share it seriously, but it's like, can you say something along with the post?
It's called plausible denial.
Yes. So, you know, people who take the pro-truth pledge, that's not what they would do or shouldn't do, or they should be. They are opening and welcoming themselves being called out on it if they are doing that sort of thing, because that's not a thing that is appropriate within the context of the pro-truth pledge. So, yeah, and the pro-truth pledge, one of the things that the pro-truth pledge is clearly defines what misinformation means from the perspective of the pro-truth pledge. It applies only to things in the public discourse and not, you know, private statements. You know, if my wife asks, does that dress make her look fat? I have the full right to say it.
I abstain from.
Hey, that's an opinion thing. So.
Yes, but you know what I'm saying. So that's one thing. It's also, I mean, the reason that the Episcopal bishop and other clergy members can take it is that we don't include any sort of abstract faith value statements as part of the pro-truth pledge. You know, it's only things that apply to public discourse. Now, if you make a claim that God came and told you that environmental change is not caused by human beings, that's, you know, you got to prove that God came and told you that. But if it doesn't relate to public discourse, it's like supernatural stuff, that's fine. Because one of the things we want to do is work with religious people. Otherwise, we're not going to really make a big public impact if we're not going to be able to work with religious people. And so that's one of the things that we have a number of exemptions like that for things that don't have to do with public discourse. Pledge is solely limited to that. And it's about, you know, there are three things we define as misinformation, things that are clear lies, like, I don't know, Barack Obama's daughter replacing the G20, things that are clearly didn't happen, or, you know, Pizzagate. Then things that reliable fact-checking organizations have shown to be not true. And in order to avoid accusations of bias, we just are going with the fact-checking organizations that are used by Facebook in its fact-checking program. So Facebook has a huge incentive to use the best quality fact-checking organizations available. So we're just going with those fact-checking organizations. That's two. And the third thing that we define as misinformation is something that goes against the scientific consensus. Science is the best tool that we as human beings have of figuring out the truth about reality. So if there's a clear scientific consensus on something, then we consider that to be a clear determination of reality, whether it's about, you know, climate change being caused by human beings in a significant way, or that vaccines do not cause autism and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm hitting, you know, I think that's a typical talking point on the right and a typical talking point on the left about vaccines and autism.
Yeah, so evidence-based policymaking is a strong goal here, I think. Is it?
Yes. This is evidence-based policymaking, but even before that, evidence-based discourse. So it's the, you know, when Trump tweets something that's false about, let's say, that he won the popular vote, or when he retweets something about Pizzagate, that's not about policy. That's about discourse. And destroying our public discourse, destroying the trust in our public discourse, destroying the honesty is the fundamental problem here. So there's a lot of research showing that trust is crucial to enabling a democratic political system to function. People comply with laws not because they're being watched, not because somebody's going and making them comply with laws. They do it, vast majority of people do it voluntarily. You know, if people started trying to break laws, our system would fall apart in Canada, in the US, in the UK, and everywhere. There's a difference between authoritarian systems and democratic systems, where authoritarian systems spend much more resources on ensuring that people comply with laws, because people are not willing, they don't have buy-in into the system. They don't invest, they don't trust the system. So they're willing to screw the system in various ways and take resources for themselves. You know, one of the reasons that the Soviet Union fell apart and other authoritarian systems have trouble managing things, because they have to really invest a lot of resources into suppression, repression. Democracies don't, because people have buy-in. If you destroy trust, people don't comply with laws. People have polarizations. They have fights. It just goes and, you know, it ends up in collapsing into some sort of authoritarian regime or some sort, like we see happening in Turkey right now. It happened in a number of Western democracies, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Germany, and so on. So to prevent that sort of thing, to prevent this collapse into authoritarianism, destruction of trust, the pledge is a center of what we're calling the pro-truth movement. And it's something that is quite similar to how the environmental movement got started in the early 1960s with the pollution, addressing the pollution of clean air and water. And we're trying to address the pollution of truth and trust in our political system. And it's solving quite similar problems in some ways. It's both are really harmful, and nobody has a clear incentive to solve environmental pollution. You know, polluters have a huge incentive to pollute. No one has a clear incentive to stop pollution. So people have to come together and solve the huge coordination problem of coordinating many, 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 many people who have an incentive to stop pollution against a small, powerful interest group of polluters who want to pollute. Here we have a similar thing. Many, many, many people have an incentive to stop lies in politics, but a very small group of people have a strong incentive to lie because it causes them to win. So that there's a lot of similarities, and we're borrowing the most effective methods of the environmental movement to launch the pro-truth movement. And the pro-truth pledge is simply the central aspect of it. So this is why we want as many people as possible to go to protruthpledge.org and sign up, take the pledge, and vitalize in politics through that simple step.
I have one quick question. The paper by Peter Boghossian and Randy, who's the other author?
Lindsay.
James
Lindsay, yeah.
Yeah, The Conceptual Penis. In the style of the Sokol hopes, I should say. Would you say that that is deceptive, or would you say it's advancing an important, you know, by using, I guess, a call out method to call out bad ideas?
Yeah, I think that's advancing an important method. So it's not, you know, it's not something that's inherently deceptive. It is a method that they used and they revealed afterward that they were using something that was deceptive, but in order to address a fundamental aspects and problems within a commentary in the humanities. So I think it's a good project that they did, and I appreciated them doing it.
Yeah,
the deception was not... They always intended all along to disclose. So if they hadn't had any intention to disclose, I think it would be a problem.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a similar way to, you know, if someone goes undercover, I wouldn't call that person someone who's inherently deceptive.
It's an absolute necessity. Anonymity is necessary to achieve an objective, and I mean that both in you know, as a goal as well as to be objective, because if they would never have gotten it published if they'd known who it was publishing this, trying to publish that paper.
Absolutely.
It's just a necessary problem.
Yeah. When I go on conservative podcasts, I don't say that, you know, I'm a baseline liberal and that I'm secular. You know, I talk about, hey, here are things that we share, or we both have a commitment and concern about the truth, right? So truth is really important to us. Let's talk about what are truth-oriented behaviors. And let's talk about these truth-oriented behaviors. Can we both agree that these are truth-oriented behaviors? And the conservatives would generally go, yes, these seem like truth-oriented behaviors. Great. So let's see where these truth-oriented behaviors lie, who exhibits these truth-oriented behaviors, what are problems in our political system where these truth-oriented behaviors aren't exhibited, how can we do more of these truth-oriented behaviors? So we talk about things we share. Like I said earlier, a fundamental mistake that people make is thinking that, you know, focusing on the 3% of difference rather than the 97% of similarity. That and when I go on conservative radio shows and podcasts, I focus on the 97% of similarity, especially about truth, since that's what I'm focusing on. You know, I don't talk about the 3% of difference that would make them, you know, not want to talk to me.
Yeah, but you can only have that discussion when there is common ground. Now, if somebody comes to me and uses the critical theory definition of racism, which is prejudice plus power, I can't accept that. I mean, there's no common ground. How do I deal with that?
Yeah, I think that's hard. I think you'd want to ground it out in behaviors and see what kind of behaviors result from each interpretation. I always try to look for common ground. So if I have a theoretical difference with someone, I try to ground it out on specific and concrete behaviors. You know, how would the specific and concrete behaviors be different under one interpretation than and under another interpretation? And then I talk about those behaviors and see if the person finds some behaviors unacceptable that I would also find unacceptable. And then I would focus on the overlap of unacceptable behaviors and say, hey, can we collaborate together on making sure that these behaviors, you know, let's say we find 60% of the behaviors that we both agree on are unacceptable. Can we collaborate together in such a way as to reduce the amount of unacceptable behaviors in our society? Mm-hmm. So that's a really easy way of collaborating with someone who has a really powerfully fundamental theoretical difference, but not focusing on the theoretical difference, focusing on the similarity of, you know, what are behaviors that you're concerned about.
Yeah.
Basically, that racism is not a desirable thing you want in society as a whole. Mm-hmm. I just don't like that. Being labeled as a racist just because I'm white.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, nobody does. I mean, but, you know, I don't like being... There are lots of feminist activists who don't like men as a category.
Oh,
but there are. But, you know, I'd be willing to work with them if they'd be willing to, like, work with me and say, hey, I totally hear you. There are definitely lots of men who do lots of bad stuff. Let's talk about stuff that we both agree on that men do that is bad, and let's talk about how to reduce that amount of bad stuff that men do.
Yeah.
So there's still, you know, and I bet that about 80% in that case, I would say 60% in the, you know, racism case, but 80% in the, you know, men case doing bad stuff, I would agree on with that feminist, even if, you know, if I focus on the conceptual, like her not liking men, then that's her
problem.
Right.
Then, not that's yours.
That's not going to really get me anywhere.
Yeah.
So I really focus on trying to look, step back, step above what's called meta, look at what we share and focus on working on that. And that's what I think, that's one of the things that really needs to happen in the pro-truth movement, you know, have a big tent. You know, Aaron Ra, who is, you know, as far anti-theist as you can pretty much get, right? So on the one end took the pro-truth pledge, and the Episcopal bishop on the other end took the pro-truth pledge. If they can work together, you know, to achieve a common end, you know, that's great. That tells you something about the power and the potential of an orientation toward the truth. I mean, I bet you that Aaron Ra wouldn't have thought before the Episcopal bishop took the pledge that the Episcopal bishop would take the pledge. And his name is Pierre Whelan, if someone's curious. So that Pierre Whelan would have taken the approach of pledge, but he did, and that's great. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to work with him, as I'm happy to work with Aaron Ra. Mm-hmm. Although my values lie much closer with Aaron Ra. But.
Yeah.
So this is a very diplomatic endeavor. A lot of this diplomacy involved.
Yes, very much so, and a very big tent endeavor. I make very clear from the start to people that this is a big tent endeavor, and we're going to focus, you know, we all have different fundamental values. You know, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, you know, we can have very fundamentally different values. What we're going to be working here is a shared method, shared process of agreeing on these 12 behaviors as really, really, really important to, you know, fix the mess that our society has gotten into, that our societies, democratic societies around the globe. It's an international project. Heck, we even have people from Iran take the pro-truth pledge, you know. I mean, it doesn't get much more authoritarian than that.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, and the guy who took it is, I'm pretty sure he's a guy. So he goes by Keve Musavi. He's one of the Patheos bloggers, secular bloggers. Mm. But that's a pseudonym. So He's a he presents as male. So democracy activist in Iran, but it's a pseudonym. He can't reveal his real name. Otherwise, you know what happens with secular bloggers in those countries.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah. So he took the pro-truth pledge because, you know, he doesn't think that Iran, it will happen in Iran, but he wants to contribute to making a difference and spread these ideas among like-minded people in Iran. So this, but it will have a much more of an impact in democratic countries where people, like I said, as far apart as Aaron Ra and Pierre Whelan can take the pro-truth pledge. And we have Democratic and Republican people taking the pro-truth pledge, politicians and so on. You know, you can name a lot of divides, though. Tell you about people who have taken those pledges, you know, who took the pledge. We have people who are libertarian, like you don't get much more libertarian than that taking the pro-truth pledge, and people who are super, you know, economically liberal taking the pledge, you know, full support for the government. So as long as they can agree on truth-oriented behaviors, and they can very easily, and I have found that they quite do, put aside their values and they're oriented toward collaborating on this shared project. And the really nice thing about people from different demographics and backgrounds taking the pledge is that they can go back to their own communities and speak the language. So, for example, one of the clergy members who took the pro-truth pledge, Lorenzo Neal, he we're trying to get him on the Christian Broadcast Network. which is run by Pat Robertson. And we have someone who has connections to it. I'm not going to name the name because this person doesn't want to know it publicly known that he has connections to it. But this person is a Jew atheist, so cultural Jew, current atheist, who happens to have connections to Pat Robertson and the Christian Broadcast Network for some, I don't know how. But he is trying to place this pastor who took the pro-truth pledge on the Christian Broadcast Network through his connections. So, you know, we're trying to get to all sorts of communities through getting people speaking their language into those settings.
Oh, that sounds like a worthwhile project. And I just signed up, by the way.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you. So we got one more.
Wonderful. Yeah. And we are definitely looking for public figures like you, Randy, and to sign up and support the Pro-Truth Pledge. And I know that Christine signed up earlier, and Twilo, would you like to sign up as well?
Oh, yeah, because sometimes I do start falling into that bias without checking, and then...
Yeah. You know, everybody does, because we do have a tendency to surround ourselves with like voices, and I find myself doing that, and I have to actually think. I mean, when I call for people to stop calling Trump voters bigots and racists, mm-hmm. because for most of them, I don't even think that's true. I think it's patently false. They voted for him in spite of Trump's tendencies towards that kind of behavior. And there are. I mean, it's no doubt that they're racist.
But definitely not all.
Yeah, but definitely not all. And he was just the first voice to speak up on things, and the only voice. That's the problem. The only voice to speak up on certain matters that were important to people that nobody else was touching. That we're denying we're even existing. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. It would have been great to have a voice of reason in those discussions, but nobody was speaking up because they're afraid to be labeled Islamophobia. That's the big one. To be labeled an Islamophobe, I think that's a huge... nobody wants to have labels pinned on them. But these days, labels are thrown around so easily. I don't think they have the effect that they should have. And because people are just it's getting thrown around so much. And it's crazy. Misogyny is one.
I hear that. Yes, misogyny was something we're talking about.
Yeah.
I think that there is a... definitely a problem on the left of using labels too way too broadly, you know, to the extent that, you know, people are like, well, you're just crying wolf too often.
Nobody cares anymore.
So yes, so that has to be something that is definitely a problem, and full acknowledge that. That's something
but that goes back to the identity politics thing.
Yes,
quite
identity politics. Yes, it's
it's very strong.
It's quite dangerous.
It's very dangerous. Yeah, absolutely. And the left just doesn't understand its complicity in the rise of Donald Trump. They're completely oblivious to it. It astounds me. you push people down long enough, they start. You reach your breaking point. I think that's what happened.
Yeah, you know? there is definitely a problem in that regard.
Yeah,
and I would love people to be able to realize it. But one of the things I get really frustrated about with the left is the whole resist Trump agenda.
What? Just one?
I'm talking an additional point.
Okay.
A big one.
This whole idea of resist Trump agenda. This personalization and seeing Trump as the source of everything just creates a huge tribal divide. Mm-hmm. Now, focusing on individuals rather than behaviors is so flawed as a approach. It's such a problematic thing. You'll be so much better off if you focus on problematic behaviors and say, hey, here are the things that Trump does well. Here are the things that Trump does poorly. Let's try to get him to do less things poorly and more things well.
Yeah.
That's such a much more effective approach.
It's constructive.
And it's constructive, and it will get you a lot of Trump supporters to agree, because many of them don't like a lot of the things Trump does. But if you just say Trump is bad, then the people who voted for Trump
think
that they feel that, oh, you're criticizing me because I voted for Trump. Well, screw you.
Yeah, that's exactly true. They've got an investment
really
in it.
It's really hard not to do that.
They can't change their
vote.
It's
so hard not to do that.
They voted for this guy. They can't change it. So they have an emotional investment in that?
It's called post-factum cognitive justification. And folks can look it up. It's called, again, post-factum cognitive justification. People tend to justify their decisions after the fact. And they tend to, you know, after they've decided something, they tend to invest more energy and efforts into it. Now, if you approach it wisely, keeping in mind that people have this post-factum cognitive justification, you could say, like, hey, totally understand why you decided to do that, you know, and I accept that. Let, you know, what can we do going forward? You know, we can accept that, you know, Trump has some good qualities and Trump has some bad qualities. Let's work on addressing the bad qualities in Trump and other people like him. And, you know, let's, you know, focus on addressing the negative qualities together and collaborating about these things. You know, I mean, a lot of people in the Republican camp don't like Trump's actual real misogyny. That's a real thing, you know, that, or they don't like that he criticizes the media in a childish way. They don't like that. It's not appealing to them. If you just get, talk about behaviors, not resisting the Trump agenda.
Yeah, well, the whole he's not my president thing, it drives me crazy. Yes, he is. Just because you didn't vote for him doesn't mean he's not your president. I didn't vote for him. I voted for Hillary. You know.
So you're president.
But yeah, this is a reality. You've got to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Don't, you know, it's just another way of denying the reality when people say he's not my president. That's not true.
I agree. Yep, yeah. I agree.
That's the system.
It is a system.
Yep.
Yeah, you agree too.
Well, it's the same with the whole Hillary got won the popular vote. Yeah. Well, so what?
Yeah,
that's not the system.
Anything.
We don't have a popular vote system. It's an electoral college system. So.
Yes. So deal with it.
Yeah, deal with it. Exactly. I'd rather deal with reality than complain about shoulda, coulda, woulda. Maybe I got that order wrong. Anybody else got anything for our guest?
Just a big thank you for joining us.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
If you want to promote anything again or looking forward to your book in 2018.
Yeah, give that title again.
The Alternative to Alternative Facts, Fighting Post-Truth Politics with Behavioral Science.
And, of course, there's the Truth Pledge at www.protruthpledge.org.
And thank you both, Renzi and Tyler, for signing it.
This was really, we really had, I really enjoyed this because it gave me a little bit deeper insight into how to change people's minds. And I'm trying very hard to be less of a contrarian and more of a constructive person.
Democratic.
It's easier to be deconstructive.
It is.
Fun.
I totally hear you. You know, I looked at the behavioral science research, you know, I used to have a lot of fun arguing with people and kind of pointing out all the flaws in their thought process and so on. But once I looked at the behavioral science research and started really going into the field, I'm like, well, it's not really actually going to change their minds. Like, what's the point? I mean, it might be fun for me, but, you know, it's not really going to be productive for the broader project of trying to change the world. So,
yeah, it depends on what your goal is, right? One is to feel good and the other is to actually do some good.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Well, it's, you know, those arguments on Facebook and stuff get seen by more people than we realize. I think there's a lot of passive viewers who are, you know, so sometimes that, you know, even though you don't change the mind of the person you're arguing with, you might raise some.
Yeah.
Well, you might raise some questions in some people's minds, right?
You have to be careful about that. It's tempting to believe that. Often the people who would be convinced by the kind of arguments you make are already reason-oriented people, whereas people who are emotionally oriented would just, I mean, research would suggest, would tend to think you're just being a jerk.
I suppose so.
I get called a jerk a lot.
Yes.
I don't have these conversations at work. Like the girls at work, they're anti-vaccine. Do you believe in vaccines? They say, and I say, well, I understand how they work, and I really don't want to talk about it.
There you go. No need to stress yourself out in that way.
Yeah.
Like I said, if you have a conversation, if you intend to have a conversation, ask people to take the pro-truth pledge first and stick to it. And if they're not willing to do so, ask them why. And that can be a healthy conversation all in itself.
Yeah. And then they start getting to the how the immune system works. And I just don't have time to educate them on that either. So I just, again, I just drop it. They just think I'm dumb and don't understand how the immune system works. And I don't want to correct them either.
Yeah, you can spend your time on more effective things.
Exactly. Like getting our work
especially at work.
Yep. Yeah.
You don't need that kind of thing at work.
I don't care if they think I'm stupid and don't understand how the immune system works and how I'm overwhelming it and all this other stuff. But they can think that all they like. I don't care.
There you go. I think that's a really healthy attitude.
Not much I can do to change it. I'm not going to.
I think it's one that's born of experience, actually.
Yeah, I'd rather have peace at work and get my work done and get paid.
That totally makes sense. I totally understand where you're coming from, and you want to choose your battles. And one of the things that this is one of the reasons I strongly advise people to see if their interlocutor, the person they'd be talking to, is willing to take the pro-truth pledge first, and if it's not, like. Is it really helpful for you to have a conversation with the person? Like, what are you going to accomplish? You know?
Just drive? No.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Gleb, for being on. It was a very interesting discussion on truthiness and its and how to counter it.
Thank you. And this was a pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on. Yeah. All right. Have a good day.
You too.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Legion of Reason, coming to you from Calgary, Canada. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please consider reviewing us on iTunes. Music was provided by Dean Morrison and Graham Hill and used with permission.